how to, which is when you ask a question, please tell us your name. So just the first name, so you can learn the names and who all of you are. So last lecture, we discussed our first postulate in some detail. I'm going to do too much detail. And then start on the second postulate, start the comp from there. So these are the postulates of kind of standard quantum mechanics, and then later today we'll turn to the discussion of the generalized postulates. Second postulate. So we associate with the physical observable of image operator. And here we're denoting the eigenvalues, the eigenvectors of some arbitrary Hermitian operator O. Determined from the eigenvalue of the operator. And this is the structural component of quantum mechanics that gives the discrete spectra. It explains why we have the discrete spectra. And the second component is the statistical aspect of quantum mechanics. That, given some state rho, the probability of observing outcome lambda, the outcome specified by lambda L, determined as so again, this is fundamental statistical nature of quantum mechanics, that we don't have definite outcomes, but probabilistic outcomes. And so this is also goes by the name the Born rule, which associates things that are observable in the lab, namely probabilities, with the structural elements of quantum mechanics. Let me just remind you of some of the mathematical properties we're using here. So here we have, first let's define linear operators, which you'll all be familiar with. Linear operators are defined by the position activity on the vector space. Operators are in general non-commutative, remember. Commutator B, which is defined as AB minus BA, we add hats to the unit operators. I'll often drop the hats, but it's at this initial level, it's a good idea to keep track of them. And then to define the Hermitian operator, which is a linear operator, we first introduce the adjoint of an operator, which we define through the inner product relation. So if you want to know what the adjoint is for A, it has to be an operator that satisfies this for all phi and psi. Elements in the Hilbert space. And in direct notation, this statement takes the form of much simplified notation. And a Hermitian operator is defined by the condition that is equal to that self-adjoint operator. And then some elementary properties of the adjoint operation, just for review. We have the AB dagger equal to B dagger A dagger, and C A dagger is equal to C star A dagger. So a complex scalar, because it's not an operator, only gets complex conjugated. In the case of matrices, the dagger operation consists of complex conjugation of the matrix and transposition of the elements. So for matrices, some matrix M dagger, M complex conjugate transpose. And an important property is that the Hermitian operator has real eigenvalues. Yes?
Sorry to talk down with computation, but is that the dagger that you've got there? Like,
oh, yes. Sorry.
Yeah, okay.
Thank you. Yes?
You're not saying that an observable must be a linear operator.
Yes, it must be a linear operator. Okay, this is one question. Yeah, actually, in all four questions. Is it an explicit case? Your Hermitian operator is definitely a linear operator. And then these are some more practical features that are necessary for computation. So a Hermitian operator emits what's called a spectral decomposition. That means is, in the case of a discrete spectrum, so the eigenvalues are labeled by a discrete index rather than continuous variables, an operator O can be expressed as some where lambda L's are its eigenvalues, and this is a projector. called PL, and a projector. Projector is defined as something that satisfies condition that PK squared is equal to PK. So if you write the operator as a sum over projector is weighted by the eigenvalues. Now, in the case of a continuous spectrum, things aren't as simple by any means, but what we can do is we can write out an analog of this in terms of a continuous spectrum, which kind of works for all practical purposes. And here, this is a method developed by Dirac, where the eigenvectors are not necessarily elements of the Hilbert space, but elements of the string Hilbert space. So I'll give some examples of this to say what I mean. It turns out that it's possible to come up with a generalized spectral theorem in the case of continuous operators where the projectors are elements of the Hilbert space. And that was a method developed by von Neumann. It was critical of Dirac's approach. Because Dirac developed this approach before one had a theory of distribution functions which needed to justify this approach. I'm just mentioning these for kind of historical flavor. Actually, Dirac came up with this approach before von Neumann. This is the translated edition I have. So, Dirac developed this sometime circa 1930. So, yes.
Now, you labeled the numbers for the operator lambda L, but that's not the eigenvalues, is it? It's just some number.
It's
my operator, yeah, that's
it.
Yeah.
You can see this by acting on an eigenstate. So we act O, no, so if you act O on an eigenstate, you see it just returns this number of times the eigenstate, which just proves that it's an eigenvalue. Now notice that in the case of a continuous spectrum, we need a rule for calculating probabilities. And what we would have is that probability lambda, this is kind of the generalization of part 2b, I guess it's called. Probability lambda lies within some continuous interval AB is equal to the trace of the interval from A to B of B lambda which makes it more familiar as we write we let and the side psi lambda, this reduces to interval A to B for D lambda, psi star lambda, psi lambda. This is kind of the familiar case you might have seen in the standard treatment of quantum mechanics in a continuous space like position space. So you can think of lambda as x. Probability that x is found between a and b, the integrate versus dx of the probability is just the modulus squared of the wave function. another very important property is that with these generalized spectrum decompositions, we can unambiguously state that it needs to have a function of an operator. We want to find the function of some operator O, same one we're using here. We can just define it as, in the discrete case, sum over lambda f of lambda times the projection. So now again, to return things to what you might be more familiar with, you could probably assume things like the expectation value of x equals an integral over dx, x, psi star x, psi of x. And this comes out of this formalism. I guess I kind of made this point already. By identifying this as expectation value of x, you can trace x times the state of psi. Right, so this is just the probability of finding lambda with an equal AB. We plot the average value of x, then we obtain something different. There's a weighting now for the x in the expression. And this comes out by writing down the spectrum decomposition of x. We have to trace x spectrum decomposition of dx, x times the projectors onto x times psi. And then this reduces to integral over dx. So we use the same property of the trace, which is that we can basically bring the graph to the left hand side. And we get the average value of x. Yes?
So what is psi? Psi is the spatial system?
Psi is the representation of the vector, so the complex function psi of x, is we take the abstract vector and represent it in a particular space, which involves taking the inner product of the abstract vector with the basis of the space you're interested in. So in the postulate 3, we'll identify what we mean by how we associate a basis of a vector space with a physical observable. That comes from postulate 3. So for now, you can say you have some basis that you have some physical identification for, take the inner product of the vector with the basis elements, and that gives you the continuous function of that space, or a column vector in the case of the discrete space.
Well, I'm just wondering, like, where does this psi come from? Is it a stable function, or the psi itself?
That psi is similar to this psi, or this one?
This one, yeah.
This psi is a postulate 1. It represents It's the non-negative operator that we use to represent a particular configuration of some system.
So it would be the state of the system.
Oh, so it's the state of the
system. Oh, yeah, sorry. So this is all given, given some state psi. Right? All these probabilities are state dependent, so one has to specify what the state is to calculate anything. So we can just make that explicit. Psi is the state. And observables always depend on specifying the state. Yes?
Why isn't it the definition of x, psi star x, and then x in the middle, psi x?
It is, but it turns out that these are now all just complex functions, so the these are complex functions, so not operators.
Okay.
So it doesn't matter. But what you find in the case of momentum, just to give another example, which I'll do very quickly, in the case of momentum, you have the case that you have integral over dx, psi star x, and the momentum operator, as you see in the next postulate, is I star d by dx, which is a differential operator. So then the ordering matters. That's maybe what you're familiar with. But this is just a special case where the ordering doesn't matter. Because, and the reason why it doesn't matter is because we express psi in the position representation. You can also calculate this in the momentum representation, and then p just becomes a simple complex number. Okay, two last points about maybe using the right order, which is that we have
The producing result is the resolution of the identity. Which is any basis lambda L. And it also works in a continuous case. It's called the resolution of the identity. Technically meaning spectral resolution. And the identity operator is just what you think from the name. It maps any vector to itself. I mean, I'm decomposing some factor operator as a sum of projectors. These are, this is called the spectrum. So I'm kind of decomposing the identity in terms of projective elements.
Wait a second. So you represent the an operator as a sum of all its eigenstates. All average operators can be composed of that.
Okay, so now I'm going to turn to postulate 3, which is how we represent dynamics in quantum mechanics. We need something longer. I did this in the wrong order, I guess.
Can I just ask, X is an operator. I need a trace.
Here's an operator.
It's not an eigenvalue at all.
Here's an operator. And here's an operator. Okay. So, I mean, basically, the idea is that once we run. Okay, so postulate 3. Our last postulate. So we demand that dynamical transformations represented by unitary operators. So we have some transformation which takes the state characterized by psi 1, psi of s 1, psi of s 2. We demand that transformation be represented by unitary operation on the vector. We can also express this in terms of rho of s 2, u. S1, the dagger. So now I'm going to put meat on the bones of this. Okay, well, people will be writing this down, so I'll transfer it here. Well, first, we note that the unitary operator is, of course, it's defined by the condition that u dagger is equal to u dagger u, which is identity. Which implies that the Hermitian adjoint of u is equal to the inverse of u. as opposed to a Bermudian operator with adjunct is equal to the operator itself. And because the operator is unitary, we know it can be represented as S is some parameter of a continuous transformation, and A must be a Hermitian. If we include the I here, the complex number there. Now, historically, the physical content of the theory, the association of abstract operators with physical quantities, was obtained by Dirac. So the historical approach was Dirac identified the operator algebra for position, momentum, and angular momentum by quantizing the classical Poisson bracket. Okay, we won't follow that approach here. I will actually define the Poisson bracket next week because we'll discuss classical theories. But for now, it'll be undefined. And just suffice to say that while this works and is an adequate approach, one of the issues with it is that one's basically demanding the existence of the classical theory in order to define your quantum theory. And you don't want to do that. You want quantum theory to be fundamental, so you want to be able to derive all the physical content of the theory just from physical principles, not from some other theory. So the way we do this in quantum mechanics is following a method devised by Jordan in 1975. So that's how long this practical approach works. Should I move this up? So we were going to do it. It's a method devised by Jordan. I presume the main kernel of this approach existed already and he just pulled it all together. But I'm not familiar with the original literature on this. Basically, the idea is to identify the unitary transformations and the associated algebra, what are called the generators of the transformation, which I've defined there as A, set of operators A. From the continuous Galilean space-time symmetries. So we take the continuous Galilean space-time symmetries that we know about. We know that these are groups. So the space-time symmetries satisfy the properties of a group. Displacement and position, displacement and time, displacement and momentum, displacement and rotations. These all satisfy certain group properties. And what we do is we axiomatically, we demand that the representation be unitary. And then,
yes? I don't know what you mean by continuous Galilean space time symmetries. That's just four words that I don't know what
you're talking about. Basically, the idea is that
So I have some transformation that generates a translation position space for space where x goes to x prime equal to x plus a. So I should be able to generate motion through translation. And similarly through our rotations, I can rotate about a vector about some axis, let theta be defined with respect to some axis. And I can rotate some new angle theta prime equal to theta plus some theta a. So I'm not going to go through the systematic analysis, but the basic physics behind it is that one can determine what group properties these transformations must satisfy. So you know that if I do a rotation by theta a, and then I do another rotation where I take theta prime to theta double prime equal to theta prime plus theta b, that I can compose those two operations. And the composition must be such that theta triple prime is equal to theta plus theta a plus theta b. So these are the physical requirements I demand. And these represent groups of transformations. And I mean, the technical details are, it's not even that technical, that are just tedious to go through all the possibilities. Yeah. And you can identify the nature of unitary representations of these transformations. And from that, you can identify the algebra of the generators. So,
generators being what we apply to make the transformation go.
Actually, the unitary operator is what generates the transformation,
yeah,
in the sense of x on the state vector.
Yeah.
So, however, we know that because it's unitary, we can express it as the exponentiation of a Hermitian operator. And just by convention, those Hermitian operators are called the generators of the transformation. And so these physical assumptions alone are sufficient to identify the commutation relations. So we have displacements in position. This form, where by convention, one is one doesn't work. The proportionality constant is determined actually empirically. So one has a unitary operator generating translations in position, which is given by the momentum operator. And from this, one gets the commutation relation x, px. Equal to I times some constant. Not the x constant, a different constant. Just some real constant c. Yeah.
Yeah. I think I said why you said that for your x from the not fundamental. You said it's not fundamental because you use classical mechanics.
Yeah, so you bootstrap your theory from classical mechanics.
Yeah, that's okay. Now, in the context of, let's say, if you go back to classical mechanics, you can say it's physics, which is fundamental. And I mean, the only thing you can derive that if you come and say, okay, one of the things in the platform there is a classical mechanics, you have to be saying. And that is the common here that everything is still being zero. That's the value.
So if you do that, strictly speaking, suppose one gives them a systematic set of mathematical axes to be quantum mechanics. If you wanted to do that, then you go Poisson bracket, and say, well, what's the Poisson bracket? Where does that come from? And so, I mean, you might as well, you can just postulate the commutation relations as a starting point and not derive them from any kind of deeper analysis. But if you're gonna derive them from some classical theory, then you have to provide all the axioms of the classical theory. So all of a sudden, your axioms of quantum mechanics, plus all the axioms of classical mechanics, just to get quantum mechanics. Whereas, I mean, actually, maybe I should mention what I just said again, emphasize it, which is that you could just postulate the commutation relations and pull them out of the air. But it turns out you can motivate them physically, find analysis of these space-time symmetries. The Galilean symmetry is the problem, because we're dealing with non-relativistic mechanics here. So Galilean space-time symmetries are relevant. And that's a more succinct, by Occam's razor, you want the minimum number of postulates required to succinctly convey the content of the theory. That's the reason.
So basically you're saying this fundamental knows that with me that's
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 that game.
the plus function X, something multiplier can be motivated by the has to make a product for work, like there's like theoretical considerations.
Yeah, I assume that the actual, there's a similar symmetry structure that motivates the Poisson brackets themselves, and so there's probably some redundancy in those additional assumptions. But the whole A state structure of class mechanics defines the diagonal variables would really be supplementary and not needed.
Yeah.
And next week we'll actually go into Poisson brackets because I think there's a lot to learn about quantum mechanics, but understanding the structure of class mechanics is neglected. Okay. So, I just mentioned we'll have generators of rotation. So this is a unitary group for rotations. We generate with these angular momentum operators J. And then an analysis of the symmetries. Basically, you know that symmetries are reversible, and so you can look at the forward transformation, the backward transformation, and expand the operators and identify conditions on the generators, and you can deduce that they satisfy the commutation relations from constant C times JK, where I should probably add a fully anti-symmetric symbol because we have JJ JI is equal to the negative function. And so this applies for X, Y, Z, Y, Z, X, and so on, and single permutations. And then the most important one we get out of this, is I move this to the top. Well, maybe not the most important, but the most noteworthy transformation is the generator of translation in time. So from the generator of translation in time, so we have some kind of we have some unitary operators representing our time translations. So we say that the state at some time t2 is going to be equal to some unitary operator to transport me from time state of time t1. So now we can use, we can define a Hermitian generator by identifying it as I h bar u mu by ut times u dagger, or suppressing the arguments of u here. And we note that h is then equal to minus I h bar times u du by dt dagger. So h is condition as required. And then a combination of these allows us to deduce so basically from algebraic properties we determine the Schrodinger equation. So this is very different than the way Schrodinger developed his equation, which was by considering Fourier representation of the position of momentum and doing a partial analysis along these lines, considering how would the state have to look if it was boosted along position, if it was boosted in momentum, and deducing this as a special case. But for anyone interested in this, I suggest two references. Just go through these quite carefully. One is Patrick Perez in his book, make the full analysis. As the Valentine, his textbook, both in the references list, and of course, to go back to the original literature, which is cited in these two references. And then it's worth noting that we have also a Heisenberg picture, which is equivalent. be called the Heisenberg representation. But that's a little misleading because the term representation comes up so often in the mathematics structure. It's a poor name for the different approach of Heisenberg to represent, where he allows the operators themselves to acquire time dependence. And then the time evolution proceeds according to this rule. And this is fully equivalent with the Schrodinger evolution. If we take, for example, a time-independent Hamiltonian, and we can represent the unitary operator as u divided by ht, where h does not depend on time. Actually, we don't even need to write that out. But if you think of some observable, some time, we'll take the state that ties into zero, a of t. Equal to psi at time zero. Oh, I got the dagger wrong. So that's when it goes in leftmost term. Dagger A at time zero U psi at time zero, which is equal to psi at time t. If you dagger operating on psi evolves it, A at time zero, psi. So there's an equivalence in whether or not we allow the states to evolve in time and the operator to stay fixed, or if we allow the operator to evolve in time and keep it fixed. Okay, so with that, we've made it through the postulates of standard quantum mechanics for closed systems and pure states. Starting with the back.
In the operator A in the middle between your unitary operators, is that a zero in there?
Yeah.
Another question here. At this point, should we have any sense of the motivation for the definition of H that you've given that?
I don't know if I can justify the particular choice except to say that this does identify a Hermitian operator, which it's easier to see in the case where we assume H is independent of time. And then the analysis is simpler. If we allow a time-dependent H, then it's a little less transparent. But again, I encourage you to look at the references and you can get more details there. So before talking about the axioms of generalized quantum mechanics, which deals with open systems and imperfect knowledge of state transformations, and also we'll discuss it in operational terms. Just want to give a quick discussion of the fundamental statistical nature of quantum mechanics by discussing the uncertainty principle. Thanks, Emma, for getting the boards ready. So you've heard a lot about this, one of the fundamental features of quantum mechanics. So it was originally devised by Heisenberg. I'm not sure of the exact date, but it was circa 1925. And there he shows, he derived this result. Delta x, delta b, greater than or equal to h bar over 2. So Heisenberg gave an analysis of this in terms of the Heisenberg microscope, which I'm going to argue is not relevant to the results you obtain. So basically, one imagines some electron located somewhere here, some aperture theta, and then I didn't review this, so I'm assuming I can just figure it out as we go along. So the idea is you bounce a photon off of the electron, and it's collected through the lens at the focal point. So basically, his analysis was that the uncertainty in the position of the electron, which is determined by the optical properties depending on the wavelength and the aperture, goes as lambda sine theta, where lambda is of course equal to c over nu. So nu is the frequency of the light, that is the wavelength of the light. And you deduce that there was, so this is your ability to determine the position of the single electron. This is the resolution. Similarly, you impart a momentum kick to the electron in the process of observation. And the momentum kick arises from the photon's energy, and it goes as 2h over lambda times sine theta. Basically, the uncertainty in the momentum kick of the electron is given by your uncertainty of where in the lens the photon was deflected into. So you're not sure exactly of the lateral, this is our x direction, we call that z. You're not sure of the lateral kick to the electron because of the, you're not sure where the photon was collected in the aperture of the lens. And so basically the sine theta factors cancel, and you get this result, delta x, delta p is of order greater than or equal to h. Notice that it's not exactly equal to h bar over 2 factor. And so the idea was that one has a fundamental disturbance, and the fact this result tells us that our ability to determine a single system precisely in terms of its complementary coordinates, x and p, is limited. Now, one of the problems with this type of motivation is, first of all, it's just a motivation. Some quantum textbook I read a long time ago said something like, the problem with this type of motivation is that it gives the students the impression that there's been a lack of ingenuity in figuring out ways to precisely determine the position of momentum rather than some kind of fundamental limitation. And indeed, I think there's a lot of truth to that. So before being, let me just make one more observation about this. Why is this different than the classical case? Why wasn't this realized classically? Well, the key feature here is that it comes from Einstein's postulate that the energy of the photon had to be proportional to its frequency. In the classical theory, the energy of the photon is proportional to its intensity. So if you reduce the intensity, if you arbitrarily reduce the intensity, and reduce the energy and momentum transfer to the object under observation. With Einstein's hypothesis, this quantization of the exchange of energy, one has this, actually, that's a misstatement. But one has the fact that the wavelength of the photon is connected to its energy. So if you lower the wavelength, you get a better position resolution, but a bigger momentum kick because it's a higher energy particle. So that's the key feature that makes this different from classical classes. But now let's turn to what this really means. And remember, how do we define something like delta x? Well, delta x squared is defined as x squared minus x squared. And here these are operators. And similarly for p squared. And now what do these things mean? Well, let's start with something simple. What does x mean? Well, x is equal to the average value over what's called an ensemble of measurements. Similarly for the momentum. So if you want to estimate this quantity and report it to somebody else, you prepare a system in some state of psi. So x is shorthand for the implicit meaning that some preparation, some system configuration being prepared, we can associate with the vector psi. We make that preparation of our system, then we measure the position, and we get a value. We make the preparation again, different system or the same system, we recycle it, we get a different value. You get a different value as long as delta x is greater than zero. So there exists preparations or states to which one gets a variance in the results of your position outcomes. And now what about measuring the momentum? Well, the same thing applies, again. And when we have that delta x is greater than zero, means we get a variance in our results, a variance in the set of outcomes. Delta P.
system is there pictorially. So in some preparation, X is the set of X outcomes. You prepare the state of psi. And you observe some distribution, which is a histogram. For each experiment is done in an individual system. And here, this quantity here, that's delta X. That's your resolution of X for any single trial. I'm writing too small, I guess I'm going to read out. This is the resolution of X for any single trial. And similarly, we have the width of the spread of outcomes, which is delta X. Now, there exists preparations i.e., there exists states, psi, for which delta x is zero. So you always get the same outcome, x, every time you do the experiment. And similarly, there exist preparations of your system for which delta p equals zero. But what we learned from the Heisenberg uncertainty principle is that no preparations exist, or are possible, I should say. That's a little bit misleading. Let's not talk about existence yet. No preparations are possible for which delta x, delta p is less than h bar over 2. So while I can predict x precisely with a certain preparation, and I can predict p precisely with a certain preparation, that those sets of preparations have no overlap.
I suppose I'm confused by your statement that there are preparations for which delta x is equal to 0, if you know, rather than it's very small.
It's equal to some, it's equal to delta x, where delta x can, in principle, be arbitrarily small. There's no fundamental limitation on the precision of the experience. So I think that Heisenberg's analysis led to a lot of confusion about what sense to make. There is probably some deep connection, although I'm not familiar with it. It may have already been developed in the literature. But there is something to the fact, as I mentioned, that once we have this relationship between our massless particles, which are our best protons, photons, and in fact their energy is related to their frequency, and their wavelength is inversely proportional to their frequency, that pretty much sets you up for this barrier. But I've never seen any kind of systematic founding of that, except by some simple Fourier relationships, which I never find fully satisfied. But so that's something to bear in mind. I actually prepared a few quotes, since I was feeling a little bit nervous about saying people like Heisenberg are wrong about something. So let me refer to greater authority.
Put the blame on somebody.
So my first quote from Oscar Perez, who is very much a great physicist. His papers inspired me quite a bit when I was learning about foundations, and fortunately passed away this past Saturday. But the way Oscar puts it is, the uncertainty relation is not a statement about the accuracy of measuring instruments. On the contrary, its derivation assumes the existence of perfect instruments. The only correct interpretation of the uncertainty principle is the following. The same preparation procedure is repeated many times and is followed either by a measurement of x or by a measurement of t. The various results obtained for x and for p have standard deviations, delta x and delta t, whose product cannot be less than h bar over 2. There never is any question here that a measurement of x disturbs the value of p, and vice versa, as is sometimes claimed. These measurements are indeed incompatible. They are performed on different particles, all of which were identically prepared. And therefore, these measurements cannot disturb each other in any way.
The uncertainty relation only reflects the intrinsic randomness of the outcomes of quantum tests. Another quote from Ballantyne, which is largely redundant because I won't go through it. But let me point out one thing which kind of became clear to me in preparing these lectures. So next week we'll hear a lot about Bohr and what he says about quantum mechanics. And most of the statements will sound like some kind of cross between positivism and postmodernism. But they make a lot more sense when you bear in mind that whenever he talks about complementarity, what he's referring to is the fact that the experimental setup for measuring x and the experimental setup for measuring p are different contexts. And actually, there's one more point I want to make here. So he wasn't as enamored with Heisenberg's interpretation as Heisenberg was. Different contexts for measuring complementary coordinates. Different contexts are required for measuring complementary variables. So I would venture to guess, complementary observables, I should say, that in the context of the Heisenberg microscope, sending in a very low wavelength photon is what you want to do, which you get a very long wavelength photon is what you do to send, you get a very accurate measurement of the momentum. And a very short wavelength photon, you get an accurate measurement of the position. And these are different contexts for performing the measurement of the particle's position. But there's one more aspect of complementarity, which is more mathematical. And we'll see that if we consider the generalized Heisenberg uncertainty principle. So this is called the Robertson inequality. So Robertson proved and actually, Ray, I was thinking this might be an appropriate assignment problem to derive this. I mean, it would be no more difficult than getting out the reference and going through the argument yourself. What do you think? Okay, so this is, the first assignment problem. It's the proof, to go through the proof run by Robertson. So Robertson proved that for any two operators A and B, so where A and B is the common fit, and here, where we have x and px, starting with the ideal bar, we recover as a special case, delta x, delta p, greater than or equal to 2. And then this is the other aspect that, and this is the other aspect I think of Bohr's thinking, which we'll see next week, which is that really complementarity can be represented by a very quantitative, mathematically quantitative object. And it's the degree of non-commutativity between two operators. So the degree of complementarity is the degree of non-commutativity. And again, with these thoughts in mind, I hope that some of Bohr's statements should be able to make more sense. Although his thinking was very, very nuanced. And so it's difficult to get a clear handle on what he had in mind.
It's not clear to me the relationship between different contexts and complementarity. For example, I can take x and p, which we call complementary. At least I think you mean sets of the angle that they don't commute. But we can take x of one particle and x of another particle. which also require different contexts for measurements in a sense. You know, one's here and the other's there. But they can be just fine.
I don't know if that's true because different particles being, I can compare different particles and then the preparation procedure is different, but the experimental setup for measuring position can be the same, whether it's an electron in front of the microscope or whether it's a positron or a proton.
Okay.
So in some sense, there's the preparation can be different to a different object, but the experimental setup is the same. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily want to have to defend Bohr's view.
Yeah,
it is kind of rough to view it, but I think there may be, generally speaking, no one can really nail them down, so.
I accept that, though.
Yeah, although we have to be very careful not to be said further, I guess, because suppose that we have, when you see the particles, you implicitly think of two independent things, so their operators would commute, so you can make them at the same time. But suppose that you have something where we have a third parameter, which would make these two particles kind of start to add at each other.
Okay.
Then it's not that clear anymore. So your question, I think, was very good, that we want to be sure that we don't have a circular argument in here, that implicitly, when you say something which is, can be measured at the same time, you're not assuming that they have to automatically commute, or maybe these things are equivalent.
Yeah.
Verify it.
In any case, we safely have the mathematical formalism to keep us honest about these things, but as you will see, the Bohr was very much agnostic about trying to make any statements about what's going on at the quantum mechanical level. Yeah, well, what's going on philosophically at the quantum mechanical level. All right, so the next task is to talk about it.
Questions?
Yeah.
Just the certain principle which originally like a phrase part over two, then their conjugate variables, right?
Yes, they would work.
So does that mean that the commutation relation for any two conjugate variables is I
bar? No. Yes. I think so. When the example that comes to mind is between the Wendel operators, which don't satisfy this. And there, but the components of an angular momentum vector are not canonically conjugate variables. So you have the canonically conjugate variables for angular momentum classically in quantum mechanics. Well, quantum mechanics is not really well defined. But classically, the canonical variables for an angular momentum are jz and the angle phi, which is the angle in the xy plane. So these satisfy Poisson bracket relations that I think is IH bar, but in dimensions of H bar. And so it might be true that all canonical conjugate variables have. Yes, it must be true, because Poisson brackets imply that the canonical commutator is equal to 1, and Dirac's approach, which is consistent, is to associate IH bar with that. So, anyways, this is because I won't go into, we'll discuss classical theory later. Conjugate variables are really only well-defined classically. Quantum mechanically, we just talked about commutativity. And I think the use of conjugate variables is a little bit sort of loose type of association is by analogy to classical mechanics. And there's one thing I forgot to mention that's really interesting about this approach here, which is that the symmetries determine basically what is the lead bracket of the algebra to be a commutator which is proportional to an unspecified constant. And that constant is informed experimentally. So H bar becomes a fundamental experimental parameter. It comes in through identifying what that non-zero constant is. And that's just an interesting nuance. So now, let me motivate the generalized quantum mechanics. So what we've dealt with so far is idealized quantum mechanics. We've seen closed system evolution, maximal tests, which are pure operators, Hermitian operators which are decomposed into rank one projectors, and we've considered pure states, so maximal preparations. But it turns out that things can be much more messy in practice, so one doesn't always have maximal knowledge, and the evolution of the system is not always closed. And so we had pure states before. Right.
So pure states were defined by the condition one, if we have a normalized operator that's positive, non-negative. So we're using the Hilbert space. And then we appended this third condition, which was that trace real squared was equal to 1, which has equivalent statements of the condition on that rho is equal to rank 1 projector. So it means a projector, one dimension is 1. And another way to say that, and these are all equivalent conditions if you assume 1 and 2. Now what we can do is we can actually drop 3. So we can drop these guys and still have a theory that fits together. Basically, all we require is 1 and 2. And so where does this idea come from? Well, suppose that I'm preparing states and handing them over to you. And what I do is I have some procedure which prepares the pure state for sign 1. And I flip a coin and prepare that state with probability p1. And then I have another procedure which prepares the state for sign 2. Prepares the system described by the state for sign 2, so I shouldn't say that. And I do that with probability p2, where in general, to conserve probability, I have to have the p2 is equal to 1 minus p1. Now suppose I put all these systems in a box and I hand it to you. How are you going to describe the systems? Because you don't know which, the identity of the systems is lost. You don't know which system was prepared by what procedure. And for you to describe that in a consistent way, you have to write it as a convex combination of the two procedures. So any system that you take out of that box should be described by this state. And you'll notice that for this state, this is a simple exercise, this state, we'll find that trace rho squared is less than 1. And similarly, rho cannot be represented as a projector. And rho squared is not equal to rho. And so we call these states mixed states. Or general states. The reason for the term mixing comes from the fact that it's a mixture of two pure states. We have to be pretty careful about the terminology. Let me just say in the finite dimensional Hilbert space, first of all, so mixed states, we define them, and this becomes our new postulate 1, our generalized postulate 1, is that quantum states are determined by the preparation, the same language as last time, are determined by the condition that trace rho is equal to 1, and the condition that u, rho, u is greater than 0 for all u elements of h. And then that's it. That's all we demand. When we notice that for finite dimensional spaces, so in general, then, we know that trace rho squared is less than 1. In finite dimensional spaces, so dim h is equal to d, then we have the following inequality. So the trace rho squared is bounded by 1 over d and 1, bounded between 1 over d and 1. When we construct a density matrix by just using classical ignorance, so I know what's going on and I don't tell you how to give you a state, you have to describe it. It's what the philosophers have called a proper mixture. Now, as we'll see in the next lectures, we can also generate mixed states that are not pure, by taking a pure state over two systems that are coupled, and then tracing over the second system. that'll also give us a mixed state. And when you obtain a state by that procedure, which is mathematically equivalent, but it's a different conceptual procedure by which it's prepared, then the philosophers call that an improper mixture. And that will be defined next week. Let me just say there's one warning about interpreting this type of object. So a common way to think of this type of object of a mixed state is to say that I have some systems that are in the state of psi 1, and I have another set of systems that are in the state of psi 2. And if each system is either in the in one or the other state, and the probability represents the relative frequencies of each of those. The problem with that is that we can also define the state x as square root of a, let me call it phi 1. I'm going to define phi 1 as square root of a psi 1 plus 1 minus a square root of times psi 2. Notice they phi 2 as square root of a psi 1 plus, minus is important, 1 minus a psi 2. Defined as such, I can now take the state rho written above. I can re-express it as well, 1 half phi 1 plus 1 half phi 2. So now we can also take the same set of systems and think of them as being in the classical mixture of two different physical states. So this is called the ambiguity of mixtures. And it's the problem to do with trying to, one of the many problems to crop up when you try and take a realist view of things, that quantum systems are always in pure states and we have classical ignorance over which pure states they're in. And notice that there's an infinite set of different decompositions, like the two I've identified. Notice that phi 1 and phi 2 are orthogonal here, so they form a basis of some two-dimensional space. And of course, psi 1 and psi 2 are presumed orthogonal. But phi I and psi j are not orthogonal. So that's something to think about. We only have a couple minutes, so I won't start the next postulate, but we're going to generalize measurements from being Hermitian operators to a generic object called a KOPM, and that represents the most generalized measurement we can make. So, is there anything else? So, don't forget your assignment problem, which is to write up the proof of relative inequality. You can also find that in some of the references in the text, but I suggest you get your original paper out.
What do you want to hand that in?
Maybe we could take a couple of them.
Yeah, I'll wait till you have a couple of problems and I'll hand it in with Okay, thanks for your attention, and I'll see you next Tuesday at 2:15.
Appreciate your time.
2:15.
I don't know what I'm saying. Yeah.